Well, we've had some above average rainfall this month here in Wisconsin. And of course, this past weekend, we had many tornadoes. There were six of them, five EF1s and one EF2 tornado that I think covered five counties in the state were involved in that. We're going to talk a little bit about tornadoes, among other things, with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. It's great to have both of them back. And if you have a question or maybe an experience about tornadoes or other weather events, you are most welcome to join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Steve, good to see your smiling face.
It's good to be smiling, as usual. Yeah.
John, you're smiling too, John
I feel
Martin.
Great, Larry. I couldn't feel better.
Well, I tell
beautiful
you what.
Beautiful weather out there today. Dave's yeah, in southern Wisconsin.
You know, lots we can talk about. I wanted to also get into hurricane season. There's a lot of things that we can discuss today on the show. And again, you can join us with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Well, EF1, EF2, EF3, whatever the numbers, maybe you can talk a little bit about what is an EF1, what is an EF2, and so forth.
Yeah, that's the Enhanced Fujita Scale. So Professor Ted Fujita from the University of Chicago was interested in tornadoes in the 50s and 60s, was kind of the height of his career. And he realized you could only estimate their intensity after the fact, because nobody has a wind gauge that's going to, you know, survive a close call with a tornado, so there's not going to be any direct data on that. And so the scale is based upon his estimation of intensity, which was in turn based upon how much damage a particular storm would do. So an EF1, I think, can take trees down. EF2, it graduates in such a way. And by the time you get to EF5, you leave not a trace of a building is left, not even the foundation. And so that's how the scale works, dependent on damage surveys. So actually, we were saying before the show started that, you know, when you gave us the stats on the number of EF1s and the one EF2, they may well be revised. I think the Weather Service goes out and tries to make an initial estimate using this exact scale, damage scale. And then they may say, you know, we didn't see all of this stuff in the vicinity. We may upgrade or downgrade one of those decisions.
Well, yeah, that was supposedly, at least at first, estimated to be an EF1 that took that 129-year-old Apple Grove Lutheran Church completely destroyed.
It's amazing, the pictures I saw of that, yeah.
Yeah, and we were wondering what would they classify that as, considering right. The destruction was total. But there was nothing, seemed like, in the area that was hit. Usually you'll see the path of the tornado ripping up grass or things like that.
Right. I didn't see that in that one picture in the newspaper. And then the other is it probably was a timber-only structure. I bet there was no reinforced steel or anything because it's 129 years old. So there's a couple of things going in both directions on that. Should it be a stronger tornado or could a weaker one have done that?
Fawn in Madison has a question that relates to this, and I experienced what she's going to talk about. Let's, Fawn, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have this burning question. I must know the answer to this. On Saturday evening, when the storms are rolling in, I live on the east side of Madison. There's a period of time between 7, I think it started about 10 after 7, and it went on for 20, 30, maybe almost 40 minutes. I didn't time it. A continuous roll of thunder. Continuous low rumble of thunder. I've never experienced anything like it.
I'm with you, Fawn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I live over on the east side of Madison, too, and I was just amazed at that continuous roll.
Yeah, I had friends on the west side we visited with yesterday morning, gave me the same story. And my guess was that I had looked at the radar when the thing came in, and it was a pretty intense little line, maybe stretched 100 miles from the northeast to the southwest, right across the, like a belt across Dane County. And so my guess is that you had so many individual thunderstorm and lightning events going on within that line, and they're not timed. They're not sequenced like a fireworks show. They're all kind of random. And so there's a rumble from each one of them, and it just creates this cacophonous chorus of the rumbles at different frequencies, different volumes, and it was amazing that it rolled forever.
And so we normally live on the north end of town, but we were visiting people on the southwest part of town, and so we didn't have that real crazy rain that some had it, but I kept checking the radar. There was lightning all over the place.
Yeah.
Lightning strikes everywhere.
There was a lot of it.
And that's just going to give you that thunder that's just not going to go away.
Yeah, no second of silence. Yeah, from that.
I'm with Fawn. I've never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just sitting in the living room. I think I had the TV on, watching something, and it just kept going. And I thought, I wonder, can that really be?
Yeah,
continuous thunder?
Rolling thunder. I think that's what people refer to it as, kind of colloquially. It's rolling thunder.
Yeah.
It's a great word.
I got up and sat out on the porch a while, and I said, that's thunder.
Yeah.
And you didn't see much lightning. All you saw was the thunder, or heard.
Well, it could have been higher up in the cloud, not striking the ground, just going cloud to cloud.
Why, I mean, you'd get an occasional one maybe, but... Yeah. Mostly it was just that rumble, and I thought, God, is there a tornado coming, or what's,
Distant lightning strikes along that line are contributing to the sound, and you can't see the light. Just like the heat lightning, you hear about.
Oh, right, yeah.
You see the lightning, but it's so far away, and it's so isolated that the thunder has kind of gone away. Yeah. But if you got a whole collection of thunderstorms firing off at the same time, you hear a roll.
And, of course, if you hear thunder, then there is lightning. And going on your back porch to look at it is probably not the best safety. Just want to get that out there.
Good point.
Well, here we are. Through the end of May, we had 23 tornadoes. That's through the end of May.
Hmm. Yeah.
Not counting
now we're
six
up to 30,
we just
right?
had.
Yeah. At least 30. Yeah.
And 23 is the what we normally see in a year.
Yeah.
And this was a little piece in the Wisconsin State Journal.
Yeah.
Noted that this
morning. And I'll say this, too. I mean, really, the state maximum tends to be in July and early August, not in May and June. So we got a nearly record season already at what's approximately the beginning of the peak
season.
So,
right.
It's going to be a wild summer that way, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, even if nothing else happens, that would still be true.
And this started way back in February.
Yeah,
and we got
that's right.
our first tornado in February.
And that was in Dane County. It was in Belleville.
Yeah. Right.
So
that's right.
Not far away, not in some weird part of the state. Right here.
Yeah. Jack in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jack.
Hello there. I have a question relating to a program many months ago when the weathermen were on. They were speaking about, I believe he was the first head of the meteorology down in Madison, but he was also instrumental in World War II in helping to lay out the bombing runs, et cetera, because of I don't know if it was jet streams, et cetera. And I know they had mentioned there was a book out by on that individual, and I was just wondering who that was.
Is that Reed Bryson, maybe?
No, I think it's my book. I think he's talking about.
Oh,
I think it's your book.
Yeah, I wrote a biography of a scientist named Reginald Sutcliffe, and it was published a couple of years ago. And the name of the book is Reginald Sutcliffe and the Invention of Modern Weather System Science. And you can, Purdue University Press published it, and you can probably find it online by that title. Just write Reginald Sutcliffe, and it'll probably come up in your search box. But he played a big role in the English Air Force, well, Royal Air Force, in the bombing of Central Europe and trying to beat the Nazis. So he was a big forecaster at the time. He developed our science as a response to some of the things he learned in that setting.
And that was John Martin talking, by the way, J-O-N Martin.
Yeah.
M-A-R-T-I-N. If you put that in, too, John Martin, author, UW, it'll pop up.
Yeah.
It's a good book.
Yeah, it was a good book. And it's been probably 2 years since we actually talked about it. So, Jack, your memory's pretty good.
It is good.
Appreciate it. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Did get an email. Jill heard that there may be a derecho event tonight in southern Wisconsin in the areas where the tornadoes went through this weekend. And Jill's question is, what is a derecho and how does it form?
So a derecho is it's sort of much different than a tornado, although it's associated with severe weather. It's typically straight line winds, usually accompanied by heavy precipitation as well. I hadn't heard yet that the forecast was for a derecho. I did see that we're looking at some heavy precipitation early morning tomorrow, so the 3 a.m., 4 a.m. Time frame, heavy precip again, and some potential for severe weather.
Yeah, and I saw on the satellite picture today, just coming over, the sort of telltale sign you start to see, again, this is about 2 weeks early to mid-July, the so-called ring of fire, which is a continuous convection over the international International Falls boundary water area at the crest of a ridge that tends to form in the central United States. That spawns a lot of these derecho-type storms, these strong straight-line wind events. One of the most famous ones occurred June 24th, or what was it, 5 or 6 years ago? Remember that? The one that marched
all the way across from Dane County
to Maryland.
Yeah.
So they can be long-lasting. This one was a day and a half long going across all of that stretch. And so this is the time of year for them. And what they are is thunderstorms, as Steve said, severe storms are involved in them. So thunderstorms can not only make the air rise up and down within the column of the storm and, you know, produce precipitation, drop hailstones and whatnot, but it can also move air from different elevations from one spot to the next. And so sometimes these derechos, the air is mixed from the jet stream level right down to the ground. So you're bringing air that doesn't change its momentum from having a 70 meter per second horizontal wind speed right down to the ground. And it'll not really pay much attention to your barn or your house that happens to be in the way. It'll just blow it right over. And so there can be really substantial damage from these things, even though they're not tornadic.
Yeah. And the damage is very different from a tornado where it's just, you can still get total destruction, but everything's laid in one way.
In one direction.
The wind is running straight, not
Yeah, that
spinning.
Went through an area where, in the Shawamigan National Forest, I spent a lot of time. I've talked about that in the past. And seeing that from the air, we had aerial, had a friend who was a pilot, so we flew over it.
Yeah, those blowdowns are.
It just blow down the
all
the
trees
in the same direction.
In the same direction,
It's amazing power.
Yeah, amazing power. Our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin with us today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from UW-Madison. It's great to have them back, as always, on the last Monday of the month, which Steve reminded me, this is the earliest last Monday of any month you can get.
Yeah, right. This is right, the Monday before, right? Next Monday's the first.
Yeah. Oh, man. Dean in west of Denver, Colorado. Welcome to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, folks. I wanted to fill from last program. Thanks very much for having Coast Guard on. We take our sailboat up from Colorado to Wisconsin, to Bayfield, actually, Coast Guard station there. So shout out to you. Thanks for having them on. We really appreciate them. The other thing I was going to pass along, too, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the word normal and average with regard to weather. My master's advisor, Helmut Landsberg, would say, no, weather is always normal. It's whether it's above or below average is the significance.
Yeah, normal is a statistical term.
Yeah.
And we just tend to use it, not...
But you had a question for us too, Dean.
Yes, and so the question is, you know, this is another exceptionally warm year globally, and especially out here in Colorado. We're in the foothills, and it's 90. It's crazy. What are you guys, what's the latest on thinking of what's the cause for this another exceedingly warm year, and now with El Nino behind us, it's not a primary driver anymore.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the fundamental cause is we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that's a greenhouse gas that causes solar energy to pass through, essentially, and then the energy that we emit at the temperatures we have at the Earth's surface get absorbed, and that warms up the atmosphere. And then the down wind effects, if you will, maybe downwind's the wrong word to use in a meteorology show, but the secondary effects that then occur in terms of changing global patterns of the winds, changing the global temperatures of the oceans, which then also feed back to the atmospheric circulation patterns.
Yeah, and then there's local things, as Steve's pointing out, too, that if you start out the spring drier than average at a certain location, that's going to probably make it warmer than average at that location, and then that gets into a feedback effect. And it's funny how these things go. Every single spring that leads to summer has a different beginning trajectory, but if they're governed by processes that on the large scale are kind of encouraging warmth above average conditions, that's going to be really hard to shake off. And I think that's what we're starting to see summer after summer, that the encroachment of warming is really putting us in a statistical different space.
Yeah. No. Some of these heat waves we're having now on the East Coast, well, in the central U.S. as well, I mean, it's just crazy.
It is amazing. It's just amazing. Yep.
Dean, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Lee in Madison next. Hi, Lee.
Hello. Quick question for you. With all this warm weather we've having in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, how do we get hail? Where does that come from? Is there a certain altitude that the air temperature is below 32 and it freezes from up there and comes down? How do we get hail in these hot days?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Lee. The temperature at the surface is not the same as the temperature at many elevations above the ground. In fact, the temperature on average drops about 6.5 degrees Celsius, which is on the order of 9 degrees Fahrenheit, for every 1,000 meters of increased ascent. And there are days where it even be more extreme than that. And so if you get about 5 kilometers, which is about 3 miles above the ground, even if the temperature is 80 degrees at the surface, you're going to be something like 30 degrees at that level. And so 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's not difficult with the deep clouds that you can get, the convective clouds in the summertime, for much of that cloud to be well above the point where the temperature is below freezing. And so there's ice all over those clouds. And so it's easy to make a hailstone if you've got temperatures cold enough. But you're exactly right. It's the temperatures above the ground that matter.
And you guys wrote in a column not that long ago that the largest known hailstone in Wisconsin fell in Wausau in 1921, and it measured 5.7 inches.
Yeah. And the way they get that big is, as John's explaining, you need to have those cold temperatures, of course. And it's the vertical circulations recycle that frozen particle. So the frozen particle will hit some liquid water, some rain, accumulate some, get pushed back up into the higher regions, refreeze, and then so it's that collection process. And the bigger they get, the more they circulated, or I guess that's part of it. The other part is how much water is in the cloud.
Yeah, but they're both related to how strong the updraft has to be.
Yeah.
You can't keep a giant, you know, softball-sized piece of ice up in the air unless you have a 60-meter-per-second updraft, about 100-mile-per-hour updraft.
Yeah,
and that's
there was
extreme.
A 7-inch one, 7-inch stone just observed in Texas.
Is that right?
7.4 or something like that. It's just...
it's just like, yeah, that land.
And they're not
head.
Spherical, you know, now because of the way they... circle through the storm. They're often, those big ones are usually oblate, and they got, you know, bumps on the back where water would be liquid and then freeze when it got to the back of the stone as it's falling down.
So it's spiky.
It's spiky. Yeah.
There's stories of whole wedding parties in northern India, 1888, April 30th, 1888. A whole wedding party of 200 people was demolished by hailstones. And so if
killed?
Killed. Yeah. If they're that big, you can get killed by those things. Because they don't. It's not a lone hailstone. There's a whole collection of them coming at you.
Yeah.
It's horrible, frightening.
Yeah. Oh. Well, Lee, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Just amazing how big those things can get.
I know, it is.
That's severe weather.
Yeah,
that is.
There's nothing else more severe.
Oh, by the way, someone else was wondering, how fast are those derechos, those straight line winds, what kinds of speeds can those straight line winds get?
I think they can get over 100 miles per hour in extreme cases.
I mean, you're
bringing
down the jet stream, essentially.
Yeah. They can get well over 100 miles per hour.
Yeah.
I think when it gets to about 70 or more, the Weather Service calls it an extreme wind event. So there's a whole collection wind speeds above that that would qualify as extreme, but are part of what can come from one of these derechos.
Yeah,
well over 100 miles per hour.
Mary Kay in Kenosha, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, I'd like to know if the pole shifting has anything to do with climate change.
The pole shifting.
So you mean the magnetic pole?
Yes.
Yeah. Boy, it probably does in a small way. And what I'm thinking here is as climate changes and warms in particular, the ice caps, the mass in the ice caps is going to change. And that'll cause another slightly different wobble that might cause the magnetic field to change around.
Does that make sense?
But magnetic field responds to what's happening
right,
to the ice. Yeah, it's not the other way around. That's possible, isn't it?
Mary Kay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. On the other extreme, we've got wildfires I think we have 10 states right now, both on the east and the west coast.
That's another.
Well, I'll say two things about that. First of all, you never heard about East Coast wildfires in June ever before. Okay, so that's new. And it happened last year. We had the big one in eastern Canada that gave us the smoky skies in late June for us. It was remarkable, the visibility reduction. And then even the West Coast wildfires are occurring earlier. I think anybody who's paid attention to these knows they're more like a July, August, or even fall phenomena. They peak in October. So to have this stuff happening in June at the level where it attracts national attention and does the damage it's doing is again, an evidence of an encroachment of something changing in the climate, and we kind of know what that is. I should also say one last thing. This was one of the forecasts made about 20 years ago. This will be one of the types of events that will become more common and will start earlier. And son of a gun, those forecasts were right.
Yeah.
No one's forecasting a delay to the fire season, a diminishment of the fire season. So, the skeptics have to admit that. There's no predictions for that. It's the other way around.
Yeah. We're also seeing, it feels like, an increase in rain events.
This spring is a bad place to make that judgment, I think, because we had the article today, one five-day period where it didn't rain since April 1. That's it.
Yeah.
In Madison, anyway. And that's, I don't know how unusual that is, but it seems unusual to me. So, I don't know about that. But I think globally people say more extreme individual rain events are occurring.
Yeah, I think the rain events are coming heavier.
Yeah,
maybe the monthly is going to stay the same or nearly the same. It comes in fewer events, and therefore it's heavier rain.
And it can be more difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
So you're hoping for, Eastern Canada would have loved to have some heavy rain events.
You bet. Yeah. You bet. They'd have loved it as right.
Before the fires. You don't want to have them after the fires.
Yeah. No.
The soil's washed away.
But they take
away.
Them now because they got to get rid of the zombies, so-called zombie fires that are underground. They need some groundwater, I suppose.
Sehel in Hurley, we go to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like an opinion from your guests. I read a few years ago that one of the most desirable parts of the country to live in will be the upper Midwest, and that is because of the proximity to good water, as well as not experiencing the tragedies and extremes on both coasts. I wonder whether they would agree with that.
Well, since you asked for an opinion, and a lot of people are listening, maybe perhaps outside of the state, I'm going to say no way. Stay where you are.
But on the other hand, I'd say if I were somehow to inherit a fortune and I was deciding to use that fortune to buy properties, I would buy them in the upper Midwest. Yes, for exactly that reason. This is going to be a climate island, I predict, in the next 25 to 50 years. Yep.
And it's been a wonderful place to live for the last 30. I mean, it's just a nice place. People are nice. The weather is nice. A lot of the activities to do. You get seasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which you don't get in Southern California.
And the Brewers are in first place.
Well, now you changed it.
almost July 1. I figured it was time to say that.
Seal, I think the answer to your question is yes. It will be the most desirable place to live in the United States, the Northern Midwest, due to climate change, for sure. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You mentioned, somebody was wondering, you mentioned, was it heat domes? You were talking about fires, something or other.
Yeah, about the heat domes sitting over areas, which is not only hot, but dries them out as well.
So it's, how does that occur?
Heat dome is kind of a new invented word by the media. It's not a meteorological term, but the reason you get heat waves in the summertime has to do with the a flow configuration called an anticyclone, or a ridge of high pressure at upper levels that tends to make the air sink very gently. But as it sinks, it warms up. It increases the stability of the stratification and makes it really difficult to mix anything out. So you can keep pollutants. You can keep warm air and various things trapped near the ground for extended periods of time, so long as those anticyclones last. And they do tend to last a good long time in the summertime, days on end. So you can get extended periods of stagnant conditions. You can't mix water vapor out of the air that might be trapped down there. It can stay humid, muggy, polluted. And that's what I think people in the press are calling heat domes.
Yeah. Got it.
And they're over a large area. It's not just a small community. It's many states at once.
Yeah. Dick in Cumberland, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's a, kind of a three-part request here. First of all, I'd like to have Steve comment on something I've seen posted on Facebook where they're talking about these solar fields, that they not only, you know, will collect solar radiation for electrical purposes, but then it reflects an awful lot of heat back up into the atmosphere. It's causing these upward winds, and there's speculation that may be causing some weather-related phenomena. Number two, you were talking about size of hail. This is anecdotal, but I used to officiate volleyball, and there was a tornado that went through Rice Lake about 20 years ago, and my partner had a business there. We finished the game. I came home, and I'm driving south on 63, and it started to hail. So I pulled over, and right in front of me, on the road, was a piece of hail. I saw it coming down, so it had to be big. Wow. It looked like the size of a football.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not kidding. And then I stayed there for a couple of minutes, and I started lighting up a little bit, and I said, well, okay, I can go again. Again, on my side of the road, about 20 yards in front of my car, and I'm only going 25, 30 miles an hour, because, I mean, it's really raining. And a second one came down, and I saw that one, too, and I'm thinking, it's anecdotal, and I couldn't measure that because it's landing on a blacktop, but it just splattered.
Wow.
Thirdly, Steve, did you ever go to River Falls your freshman year?
No. I grew up on Long Island.
Okay, all right, because there was a fellow that I was pretty sure had your name, and I was on May Hall, and you would have been on May Hall, but that's... So that's off. So please comment on that solar radiation reflecting back from the solar fields that are out west, generally in those barren areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm trying to think now. Think back to that, because there are two things that come to my mind. One is, in terms of the impact, it probably would be local, because the fields usually aren't that big in terms of how much of the aerial coverage they take up. They do a lot of planting underneath the solar fields. I know in Wisconsin, the university has a solar field down here, down by the PSL area. Mm. They put some out, and they put vegetation below it to try and keep things from cooling down. Because what those solar fields want to do is absorb that solar energy. And then that turns that into electricity, or storage for electricity. Of course, you could also then have reflection that might go reflect energy back up. But I don't think that that's much, because they're generally dark. Mm. And so I don't think they want to reflect solar energy. They want to absorb it to convert that energy into storage for electricity or heat. Actually, they also do warming that way as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know more about it than that, so I would think that's the same thing. They don't put a particularly shiny surface on those things.
No, right, yeah, because they want that energy.
So
does that sound familiar, Dick?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then just comment on the size of a hailstone that big. I mean, I saw what I saw, Steve. I was scared.
I can imagine being scared, yeah, because that hits your windshield. That's going through.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to keep in mind that the biggest one ever is the biggest one that was ever recorded and brought to somebody do the recording. So there's probably been bigger ones, and I think you're one of the people who's seen one of the big ones.
Yeah. And unless you have an ice chest, there's no way that you're going to keep it from melting as you try to get an observation
exactly.
on what the real size is.
Yeah, let alone want to get out during one of those events and grab the thing and put it in an ice chest. I'd rather be inside a car.
Not a very good plan, unfortunately.
Yeah, because you're right. If you get one big one, there's more than one big one.
That's right. They're not usually solos.
Right, yeah.
Thank you, Dick. Appreciate it. Randy and Hayward, we'll go to you. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Larry. So I live in Hayward, the northern, northwestern part of the state, and with climate change happening, I couldn't remember if I read this or heard it from someone that our part of the state is experiencing it more rapidly than other parts of the state. Is there any truth to that? Or if you could just speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
I suppose it's possible that in some dimension of some of the climate that you experience in Hayward, you might see some rapid changes that other people in the rest of the state don't see quite as rapidly. I'm thinking about lake effect snow. If it warms up, you know, consistently year after year, and the number of times that it's cold enough to produce lake effect snow diminishes, then the total you receive at Hayward, which is famously large, will probably shrink. And the percentage change from what you used to get to what you get now will be one of the biggest signals in the state, probably, that one could attribute to a change in the climate. So it might be something as specific as that. I would be surprised if it were comprehensive, that all kinds of climate variables in Hayward were changing faster than everywhere else in the state. But I wouldn't be surprised if the lake effect snow total stands out as one of those.
And it's a great cross-country ski area.
Yeah.
And so if it is getting less, you may be observing, you know, the season ending sooner than what it normally is.
Yeah, so that speaks to impacts. Yeah. The impacts could be huge for the region.
And
noticeable
that way. Right. Because all of a sudden
that's
you can't
go
skiing in May.
Yeah.
Randy, thank you. Another Hayward caller, an emailer from Hayward, Tom. He remembers talking the 70s of a coming ice age. And has that been negated by climate science? If so, what was the evidence for that?
That's an excellent question, and I have the same suspicion. That when I was a teenager and I'm delivering newspapers, and I was thinking, this is great. These winters are exciting, one after another, 76, 77, 78, in various parts of the northern and eastern United States. And I think that spawned a mostly media-based speculation about what's going on. Are we going to get colder than normal? Are we heading into an ice age? But I think at the same time, it really kind of kicked climate science into gear, because I don't believe there was very much of that going on in that before 1970, except in the sort of drawing giant global climate maps and stuff like that, that kind of science. And so ever since, no one's making predictions about ice ages anymore, because they know the evidence is in and it's going the other way. So that's curious, and it's within my own lifetime. That does not happen anymore.
And I remember them being talked about, because I was just entering college and in this field, and people were talking about Ice Age, but I don't remember why they were thinking.
It wasn't very scientific,
as I
recall.
Maybe it was just, a couple of cold winters in a row.
Yeah, it was Farmer's Almanac science sort of spun up into a little bit of a minor hysteria, because I don't think there was any scientific... You can look back now in the literature. There's no scientific papers in the early 70s saying, watch out, the climate's getting colder.
Yeah.
Nobody
and ice ages take a lot longer to develop.
Aaron in Oshkosh will give you a chance. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. Thank you very much. If you don't mind, I'm going to address this notion of reflectivity and photovoltaic fields very simply by stating that photovoltaic fields are designed to absorb the radiation and turn it into electricity, and therefore actually reflect less radiated energy to the atmosphere than their equivalent size body of water, whether it be a murky pond or whatever. Number two, one thing that has been well documented is the thermal heat gain by parking lots and asphalt shingling roofing material in cities of a black color. That has been well documented. Number three, if you go to monoculture and industrial farming, corn as a crop releases roughly about 82% of the water that processes daily to the atmosphere. And subsequently, on the backside of a corn field of an industrial size, you will, on average, feel a 2-degree drop and an 80% rise in humidity as if you were at the seacoast. So in terms of man-made things which affect our environment, get rid of black asphalt parking lots, have all roofs be white, put up renewable energy, and stop industrial monoculture, and bam, there you go.
All right. I hadn't realized, I mean, I was familiar with all the other things you said, but I hadn't realized that the reflectivity is less than what you see over water.
Yeah, neither did I. That's interesting. Yeah,
very interesting. Aaron, thank you so much. You know, there are things, we have done things as a world to, we've been able to get together. I'm trying to think back to chlorofluorocarbons.
Yeah, oh, yeah, the Montreal Protocol, 1987.
It
got the world together, and we eliminated them, and we've saved 1 degree.
Yeah.
And lots of money. I mean, industry doesn't spend money on chlorofluorocarbons anymore. They found cheaper alternatives that don't hurt the environment.
Yeah.
The business people are smart. You know, they're not dumb. You give them a challenge, they'll figure it out. Yeah. Why can't we just accept the challenge? We used to do that. We need to do it again.
Mitch in Green Bay, we'll get to you in just a second. Just a quick reminder, our guest today, Steve Ackerman, Emeritus Professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and John Martin Professor, former Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest today. Great to have them with us, our weather guys here on WPR News. We're talking weather and climate today with our weather guys. Great to have you along. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Mitch in Green Bay, we go to you. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. I was wondering if in China and Mongolia and all the way back through Russia and into Europe, do they all have this same kind of weather problems that we are having, or don't they have this kind of extremes of with the fires and everything?
Well, they're certainly having similar problems in the sense that the global warming is global, and so they're seeing those impacts as well. They don't generally get tornadoes, so I don't think they're getting that kind of severe weather changes that we're seeing, or a number of hailstorms. Oh, they get, do get big hail, I should say.
Yeah.
Take that back.
In Mongolia and northwestern China are dry every spring and summer, and so big dust storms can develop there. And so they have problems with precipitation that are interannually variable. I don't know what this year is like for them this year, but you know, from time to time they get some serious droughts. And the same is true in Russia. And then there's a huge forested area of northern Russia that's hardly populated. So there's bound to be wildfires that occur in parts of northern and central Russia that don't even get reported because there's so much distance between people who, you know, might populate any of those areas. So I think it's a global phenomenon.
And speaking of dust storms, there was just a big dust storm that I think it originated in Mexico and then came up into Arizona. I saw some of these are fantastic. I think it's fantastic because I've been in a dust storm.
Yeah.
Not pleasant, but it was amazing photos of this big dust outbreak coming right up into, I forget what the city was in Arizona.
But, Tucson or?
I don't think it was Tucson. No, I don't reckon. It wasn't one of the big ones. It wasn't Phoenix, I don't think.
Oh, I like that.
But yeah, it's really, it's it's amazing. And part of that, again, is, I mean, they always have dust storms down in that area. It's just the frequency going up.
Yeah, and these are places that don't get much annual precipitation. So if there's even the slightest decrease in from normal, you're going to have more dust.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
I can remember driving across Arizona more than once and seeing these little tornadoes.
Dust devils.
Yeah. And some of them were pretty good size.
Yeah.
I had a roommate in college who drove down to Nevada on the weekends from Seattle just to see the hay devils, you know, and the dust devils in the plains of Nevada.
And I heard somebody had gotten hyperthermia from that.
Really?
So it won't destroy things because they're not going that strong. But I guess there can be a big temperature drop in the middle of it if you get inside
it. That's pretty cool. Because of the dramatic lowering of pressure.
Because of the dramatic lower pressure.
Wow.
Right.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Mitch, thanks again. Lee in Minocqua, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Larry, so much for having me on. First of all, I listen to your show. I've listened for a very long time. I refer so many people, especially since I work in the nursery. I refer so many people to your Garden Talk show. So I really appreciate that. I have to preface this in saying that I was a skeptic of global warming or man-made global warming. And I still am very much. We know it's gone on forever. But what I told your caller was that I just wanted to say that, one of your guests kind of referred to that back in the 70s, the
Ice Age?
The narrative about the coming Ice Age, he kind of suggested that it was media-driven. But you know what? I was in college in the 70s, and our college or our science department, they had a class, because I was very, I was really into this, but they had a class called Man and His Environment. And I took that class, and their big thing that I took away from that class was that there was a coming ice age. So, and that was apparently the current science or how it was being read. And so I'm just very skeptic about our interpretations now. But one other thing, I wish you would. I mean, there are very credible people who disagree with your guests, and I wish, because you're having these guys on, that you would have somebody on with the other point of view, seeming it is public radio. But again, I appreciate your show so much. I'll listen off the air.
This is the old equal time thing, and there are many issues on which equal time is an excellent idea. No one is publishing papers and getting them reviewed blindly by colleagues anymore, and it didn't happen in the 70s, where people were predicting with scientific reason that there was an ice age coming. No one's doing that now. And the reason why is because it's not true. And so, I'm glad that we have a chance to have this conversation. You mentioned at the beginning of your comment that climate change has been going on forever. And you used the phrase man-made climate change has been going on forever. No, it has not been going on forever because human beings have not been here forever. The climate on Earth has changed over and over, and we see that in other records. But what we've seen in the last 300, 400 years, especially the last 200 of those 400 years, is an unprecedented increase in the carbon dioxide fraction, unequaled ever before in the history of the planet. That is not divorced from our activity. The consequences of that increase are also undivorceable from our activity. So it is nonsensical to suggest that there's equal opinions on this issue. Sorry, there aren't.
And I obviously totally agree with John, and also would just point out that, there are two things. When they all align, it's just hard to refute. One is the data. The data all show something, and the physics that goes along with that data all agree. And then the interdependencies are also aligned. And so it's hard to believe that,
it's not by accident, not coincidence.
Yeah.
Rich in Elkhart Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question for you. I wonder if you could explain something to me. I'm wondering how they measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Is it by actual weight? And let me say that, let's say you have a 10-pound block of wood and you burn it. Does that mean there are then 10 pounds of the carbon dioxide molecule now floating in the atmosphere?
or how is the amount, I mean, they talk, there's billions of tons of CO2 in the air. Is that, if they put it on a scale, all the CO2 molecules, it would add up to, you know, a billion tons or whatever that number is.
Yeah.
Could you please explain that to me?
Yeah, I'm not a chemist, so I can't tell you exactly how one would technically and logistically make those measurements, but every one of the elements, and they're the compounds that are made of the elements, has an atomic weight, and you can take a bag full of air and bring it to a lab and figure out what the constituent components of that bag are. Carbon dioxide is a small fraction of any bag of air you take at sea level or anywhere in the atmosphere. It's well mixed up to 80 kilometers, but it's really a small fraction. But nonetheless, that fraction can be determined in a laboratory with sophisticated equipment, of which I'm not an expert. The same can be done with bubbles of air that are trapped in ice that are mined from, you know, the high latitudes, either in the North Pole, but more regularly at the South Pole. And you can get ice that's 400,000, 500,000 years old. And it trapped air on the day it froze with a composition that characterized the air around the globe 500,000 years ago. You can bring that to the same lab and figure out whether or not the carbon dioxide fraction in that bubble is smaller or greater than the air that's outside your window today. And that's how we can make those statements about what's happened to the carbon dioxide fraction. And I don't know an answer because, again, I'm not a chemist, about what happens when you oxidize a piece of wood. But certainly not all 10 pounds of it becomes carbon dioxide. That couldn't be the case. There's other particulates that get released from that fire, and they have mass as well. So it won't be just all carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Rich. Appreciate it. Mike in St. Lawrence wonders where the heat dome is in the atmosphere. Is it located in relation to where hail is forming?
Usually not. The conditions that produce what's been called a heat dome by the press are kind of almost exactly the opposite of the kind of conditions you need for the formation of thunderstorms and rain and the potential for a hailstorm. So I think most of the time they're going to be almost exclusive. There may be boundaries between one type of weather and another in which thunderstorms may develop, and so there might be a little bit of overlap. But most of the time they'd be exclusive to each other.
And Marilyn emailed to ask if an active sunstorm... if active sunstorm seasons have effect on the weather?
They certainly affect the upper atmospheric weather. And we see that through things like the aurora borealis. I mean, there were some good times this spring where, again, the active sun, the solar flares happen to come towards Earth and then interact with the upper atmosphere. So if you think of the upper atmosphere as having weather in things like... aurora borealis or their counterpart in the southern hemisphere, then yeah, it does.
Yeah, and but maybe weather doesn't mean the same thing as it does more colloquially, right? Like raining, yeah, or not, you, yeah, know, stuff like that.
And Tony emailed to say a couple of months ago we set records in the Madison area with temperatures 40 degrees above daily average temperatures.
40 degrees above the average? I can't recall a time we were 40 degrees above the average.
Yeah,
that's a little bit off.
Yeah, it may have been a typo in the translation here. Yeah. Mm. What would the temperature be if this occurred in the hottest days of summer? In Mexico in the past week, Tony heard they set a new all-time high of 125 degrees Fahrenheit.
I was going to guess 124.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
Because I don't think I've ever heard of, well, I'm going to take that back, because probably the Sahara Desert probably gets above into the 130 degrees.
Someplace in Libya used to have the maximum record, 134.6 or something like that. But I don't know if that's actually right.
I mean, 125 is just...
Yeah. Who cares? What's 10 degrees among friends?
Right.
When you're at 125 degrees, that's not a good place to be. Yeah.
No, it definitely is not. Yeah. And we're not in a good place to be because we've got lots of callers and lots of emails, but we're out of time. Thank you guys very much.
Well, we're coming back.
Yeah, we'll be back.
We'll be back and we'll take this all up again. Thank you so much for being with us today. And don't forget, we got this is a team effort here. Our producers, by the way, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio News.